17, which is, again, a Zoe issue. Now, when we were doing Study Hall, we, I think, had sort of assumed, just without looking at covers or solicitation, that you would hop back and forth between the two groups.
Sure.
But clearly, this isn't the case. Right. So Casey's story is put off for another issue. Why did you basically choose to focus specifically on Zoe rather than mix it up, give us a look at what all the other kids were doing right away?
To be a dick. I love doing this. Yeah, I love doing this, and I know that it drives some people crazy, but to me, there's just nothing more fun than doing one of these cliffhangers and then saying, see you in 3 months. it's just very childish of me, but I love it, you know? I mean, it's really funny because when this issue, right before it came out, everybody was like, oh, I really want to find out what's going on with Casey, you know, because we just sort of checked in with Zoe and Hunter and John. And then when we got to the end of 15, you know, after they'd read it, you know, we went to Casey in 16 and then to Ike and Jade in 17 and then, John in 18 and, you know, more than any other time, like, all I heard was, you got to get back to Zoe and Hunter. You got to get back to that. When are we coming back to this? So that was fun, you know, in terms of thinking you want to know what the next chapter or something is, and maybe that's not the part that you're the most fired up to find out about. I like doing it, and it's an advantage of a larger cast and the way that we handle the timeline and the structure of this book, you know, really allows for it. So to me, it's a lot of fun to drop something and give it some time to sort of simmer. And it's one of the fun things because I think lots of books will have a good cliffhanger moment. But you can generally be comforted by knowing, oh, you know, in 4 weeks I'll find out what happened there. And one of the things I like about this book is there's an extra layer of, I don't know that I'm going to find that out the next issue. It might be 2 or 3 issues, or it might be 6 issues before I find out what happened here. So it really helps to hopefully keep the audience on their toes and angry at me.
So, you know, we talked a lot about Zoe being sympathetic before, but I guess with sort of skipping ahead with how things play out for Zoe, this is maybe the least sympathetic representation of her that we've seen. And I feel like that we spent so much time with Zoe should have been sort of the foreshadowing that she might not make it through the story.
Sure.
Because it seemed like there was a lot of story that you wanted to get out there before she was dead. Right. But she spends this entire issue being pretty mean to everybody.
Oh, she doesn't. She doesn't. Oh, I don't know that I'd agree with you there. Because this is also an issue where she saves Hunter's life at one point. There's, you know, one of my favorite conversations that we've had in the book is the conversation between her and Hunter about Casey. You know, and her giving him, you know, that advice. And so, yeah, I think that this issue is kind of a quintessential Zoe issue in that, it's all over the place in terms of how you should feel about her. And that's, again, I think that's what makes her a strong character is, you just really don't know, where you stand with her. And you know, the intention with this issue was really to show some moments that would generate some sympathy for her, you know, and then to sort of, unfortunately, you know, remind us in the end of some pretty terrible choices that she's made. So it's a funny one because I think it starts with her being pretty tough to be around, and then you see her soften, and she gives you that sort of glimmer of hope, and then she yanks it away.
Let me take a pause for a second just to figure out. Okay, I think I know how when I ask this. This issue gives us Maggie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Maggie is, I think, instantly likable. Makes for a nice parallel, especially when Zoe is being pretty difficult. But obviously, sure. She is very much geared towards Hunter here.
Yeah.
When you were bringing Maggie into the book, was that sort of the initial idea?
Yeah, I'm really, it's one of the things about this arc that I'm the most proud of is we made people really like and connect to Maggie very quickly. She had a bit of an easy job in that I think the audience tends to pull for Hunter a lot, and we sort of felt for him with all the Casey stuff and just with his life in general. And you know, to have this girl who's, you know, paying attention to him and is interested in him and has a crush on him, you know, it's a really nice kind of moment, I think. And I knew when the character is created, you know, what her end was going to be. And it was tough, but we knew we only had a few pages to really get across who she was and to get the reader's hopes up about her having a place in the story. And it's all just part of trying to avoid red shirts. You know, I felt like we'd seen this once before with Amanda back in issue 7. But in that case, you know, her death didn't generate a whole lot of sympathy with the audience just because she was viewed as sort of a tool of the Academy and maybe not the nicest person herself. And so when Zoe does what she does, you maybe don't feel it in the gut quite the same way that you do with Maggie. And, you know, a lot of this, Joe, I think, did a fantastic job. We talk about him a lot, but I think in this arc in particular, you know, Joe became a master at acting. You know, that I can now, you know, lay out a couple of words in a script of what a character is feeling, and Joe will get it on the page in a way that very, very few artists are capable of. There are a lot of artists who, are A-list artists that get a ton of hype and attention. And if you give them a script saying, you know, Hunter, unsure but excited, and they're not going to hit that, you know, like they're not going to hit the note. You're going to get a face that's scared, you know, or yelling, you know. Joe is just such a master of character acting and such a master at conveying emotion. And he's able to create that connection between Maggie and Hunter very, very quickly. In a way that I think that very, very few artists in comics today can do.
So you kind of touched on this a little bit yourself, but knowing that she was being introduced in the same issue that she was going to die, were you mm-hmm. at all, you know, sort of afraid of what the reaction to that might be?
I didn't tell Joe that, you know, I sent him the first half of the script and then the second half of the script, and or I may have even broken it up differently than that. He didn't know until right before he was going to draw it that Maggie was going to die. And that's another example of, you know, we've talked about this before. A lot of times I won't tell Joe certain things just so that he doesn't have to lie to you. I think that it sometimes it really shows on the page, and this is one of the examples of that. I wasn't terribly worried. You know, I knew that there were probably going to be a handful of people who were going to be a little outraged, but you know, there's been lots of dying at this school, so I don't know that if you're still around at issue 14, at issue 15, you're really you're sort of past the point of total surprise that we brutally got one of our characters, especially one of the new ones.
She also, she adds a little bit of Woodrun into it by telling, or by placing the flag on Jun's shoulder, so he has to go to jail.
Yeah, this is one of the closest that I come. Again, I have some very basic ideas of the rules of Woodrun. Like mm-hmm. I said, if somebody were to, you know, offer me like a licensing deal, you know, and if anybody's listening, you know, I'm easy to get a hold of. If somebody wanted to pay me money to come up with the rules of Woodrun, I could do it in fairly short order. But one of the ideas was that in this sort of scavenger huntish game, that as you reached your objectives, you would get these flags, and that you could place these flags on the shoulders of members of another team, and that it would mean that they were out of the game. So it's sort of competitive scavenger hunting, in a sense, and the skull flags are your weapon, in a sense. So yeah, she goes into a bit of that here.
Mm-hmm. I you know, honestly, I think that's enough that people could probably put together a Woodrun at this point.
You can piece this together fairly simple,
because it's like a scavenger hunt meets capture the flag, and
exactly. That was the aim. Mm-hmm. But if you've ever tried to make rules for a game, you know, which I know a lot of us did, particularly in between second and fifth grade or so, you know that it's the problem is in the details. And so I flinched, but yeah, here's a little bit of a look in at what the rules are.
Mm-hmm. So we get these two scenes here, and there's a whole bunch of the issue, of course, but it's in Zoe's flashback with her friend Sarah, who was the we were introduced to her in the last big Zoe issue. She was the one that was I don't know if there's like a polite way to put it, but she was playing rape games with her professor.
Sure.
And this is one of those things where, you know, I kind of called Zoe out for being an unsympathetic character through this story, because she gets pretty intense on her friend here, who they're both, you know, sort of.
Yeah, of course.
I guess the way I saw it is. Oh, sorry.
No, it's tough. You're right. But, you know, Zoe has a lot at stake here herself. You know, this can ruin Zoe's life. And she's made an enormous risk on the part of her friend. Now, you know, it was you know, accidental, but the choices that she makes after it occurs put Zoe in a great deal of danger, and associate Zoe with something that she, you know, had nothing to do with. You know, it's certainly not an overstatement to say that this is something that she's right about. This could completely ruin both of their lives. So the stakes are very high, and that's why this story is what it is, because the stakes had to be very, very high. And there had to be a lot to lose, and, you know, it needed to be an ugly, messy situation. Because again, you know, Zoe says this in this issue, nobody knows what they'll do when things start going wrong. That's a big part of her character trajectory in a nutshell. And she's somebody who's had something go very, very wrong. And most of us live our lives without ever being in that kind of a situation. And so it's easy to sort of say what we would do or how we would behave, but you know, as Zoe's learned firsthand, it's tricky.
I guess the way that I see it, and we're gonna jump ahead here a little bit further in the episode, in the issue. It seems to me that, you know, when there's death and murder going on at Morning Glory Academy, it's sort of easier to stomach, I guess. You know,
right?
There's all these crazy things going on at the school anyway. So if a kid gets murdered, you're like, well, that's part of the curriculum.
Right.
But here in this issue, you know, in the last time we saw this sort of storyline, Zoe was saving her friend and accidentally murdering the teacher. But in this one, she flat out murders her friend, which is infinitely more darker. Would you agree? Because, you know, regular high school doesn't have murder on the curriculum.
Yeah, I would agree. There is an interesting distinction between deaths that occur at the academy and deaths that occur elsewhere in terms of their perceived weight within the stories. That's something that I've noticed just as I write them, that for whatever reason, it's like you said, when you're dealing within the context of the academy, and we've discussed this kind of thing before, this book trades on an understanding that there's a sort of pop culture language that everybody participating in it has already learned. And whether that's in the sort of structural and long-form mystery elements of Lost, or in the sort of unexpected and quick gore of a lot of 90s teen horror and slasher and sci-fi movies, and just all these different influences, you know, that we trade on them, and your expectations of them, and when you're at the academy, a death can often feel like a death in the faculty or in Scream or in Disturbing Behavior. You know, that it can, that you expect that in that environment, and so it's okay. When we deal in the flashbacks, again, you know, your pop culture brain is probably conditioned to think of it in a very Lostian way. The deaths probably hit a little harder. So it's been an interesting learning experience for me. But beyond that, you know, there's no question that Zoe's flashback story is just queasy-inducing from the start. You know, that there's just nothing about it. It starts in a very unseemly and uncomfortable place. And again, that's all intentional, you know. You know, in addition to the things that I was talking about before, about, you know, how sticky the situation and how messy the situation had to be, you know, it had to be something that dealt with sort of underbellies, and it, you know, it had to be something that sort of dealt with things that we don't talk about, because again, that's all what Zoe's character is wrapped up in. So, yeah, there's just nothing about her backstory that doesn't make you sort of shift in your seat a little uncomfortably, even going all the way back to her early childhood, you know, and how her mother dies. And, you know, that's something that we allude to here, that had a big impact on who she became. You know, there's just nothing about Zoe's story that isn't supposed to leave you feeling just a little sad and a little disturbed by it.
So one thing, and I, more than anything, I think I just want clarification on this. You know, Maggie is a lot like Hunter, and she makes a lot of references. And there's one line that she has that I can't tell if she's just being clever or if she's referencing something. So let's, I'm going to see if you can give me the reference if it's one. She says, "I better let you get back to ... the suffering."
Oh.
And see, like, that could literally just be her being clever about his situation with Zoe. But, you know, there's a song called The Suffering, and there's a video game, sure. and there's a Doctor Who thing. So is that her just
right.
referencing something, or is it...
Yeah, no, it wasn't meant to be a reference. It's just sort of... I think it's sort of her title for what he's going through or what they're going through. You know, because I think that's sort of how she thinks, you know. In my head, Maggie was a big horror buff, you know, and that's kind of tragic considering how things end for her. But I very much, you know, there's a reason why it's Lost Boys and Hammer House of Horror, you know, that I imagined her as being the big horror movie buff. You know, I think Hunter certainly likes his horror movies, but he likes them as part of a big, you know, sci-fi smorgasbord, you know, that he sort of likes all different kinds of things. And I think Maggie probably does too, but I think her primary focus leans more in that direction. She's probably more The Shining than Blade Runner, you know, if that makes sense.
Right. No, yeah, that makes sense. So we've got June's out of the picture now. We just got Hunter and Zoe on their own little adventure here. And they come across the Shire, right?
Wouldn't it have been amazing?
Come on.
You know how tempting it is? You know how tempting it is to look like this for me to not have you open the door and have Bilbo?
You know, we've sort of talked about geography, but, you know, looking at this sort of like the cave in the a couple issues ago, did you... obviously, I don't actually think you're trying to reference the Shire, or that you know, Joe might have been actually trying to reference the Shire here.
right.
You know, with this setting, with this place, is that a conscious idea in your head that you need it to look like this on the outside and this on the inside?
Yeah. I mean, the script was reasonably specific, I think, here. You know, that we wanted a door built into a hill but you know, I give Joe a lot of room in terms of how he wants to visually interpret the stuff. It was important that the outside looked nothing like the inside, just for the story's sake. But that's the important bit there.
So what's a lab doing out in the middle of nowhere on the side of a hill?
Right? what bullshit. These guys are making this up as they go along. Yeah. It's a weird place for that, right?
It is.
Or maybe it isn't.
I will say that it does look a little bit familiar. Mm-hmm. It looks a fair deal like the similar setting, if not the same setting, as something we saw in issue number 10.
You think so?
I do think so.
Well, okay.
Care to comment or not comment?
No. I got nothing to add there.
Really,
at the end of the day, a lab is a lab, right? Place you do work.
I wasn't sure, actually, and we see what I will presume here. I'm sure you probably reference him differently in the script, but we see what appears to be just a writer signing books, probably at like a book signing or something. This might be more of a Joe question, since I know he does a lot of the Easter eggs. But given the placement of this character in the middle of this sequence, I had assumed that this is more than just a mere cameo. Is there something, or someone perhaps, specific that you were hoping to evoke with this character?
Yes, and it's an important moment. In terms of the look of the character, Joe is probably the person to talk to there. But
okay.
Yeah, it's obviously not dropped in there by chance.
Mm-hmm. And everything goes pretty pretty haywire in this sequence. And what I like about it, you know, outside of all of the craziness that Hunter starts spouting, which is very Jade-esque, if I might be so bold as to say, she finds a bag. And in this bag is sleeping materials and a knife. And previously we talked about one of the ideas that you had for Woodrun, which was a scavenger hunt.
Right.
So, you know, why would someone leave kids a butcher's knife in the middle of a sleeping bag?
Right? That's ridiculous. That's awful. That's awful teaching. That's not what your job is.
It's almost as if someone is doing this on purpose, right?
I know, right?
Like, you know, the knight coming out and now a weapon here.
I agree. Somebody was not very careful in their packing.
That's probably one way to look at it. So now we get that scene that you were talking about earlier where...
Oh, we have to point out here that...
What did I miss?
Joe Eisman, God bless him, has had to draw more kids puking at this point than I would venture to guess anybody in the history of comics. Nobody has had to draw vomit more than Joe. And if you notice, Joe is getting more enthusiastic about it the more they vom. Like now it's full-blown, like, cannon vomit.
Yeah, it is. It's
massive, like, projectile, like it's like a garbage pail kid. I love that. I had said, you know, like on Twitter once that if we were a TV show, somebody long ago would have cut together every vomit scene and put it some music. that would have happened ages ago because we're begging for it. So yeah, anybody with a Tumblr out there, and a lot of time to kill, I would love to see the puke montage.
Just put it together with like the music from the Benny Hill show where they're all running through doors.
Yep, something like that.
All right, hold on. I have to put down in my notes that Nick Spencer likes when kids vomit. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this is that scene that you were talking about.
That's gonna be Spencer supports eating disorders,
right? Yeah, I know. So here's that scene. It's a very, you know, this is about as a monologue-y as I think you get in the entire series, because it's a very, you know, Zoe talking heavy moment.
Yeah,
and there's not a lot. You don't really do a lot of preaching, I would say, with the character. Like, you never give a character a moment to have a soliloquy.
Sure.
But, you know, obviously in this issue, when Zoe is kind of getting at least in my view, she's getting a bad rap through all the various events, both in her past and in her present, you know, I guess you're right. It is kind of nice to just give her this moment where she... I want to say that her language is maybe a little bit harsh. And it's sure. very blunt.
It's a harsh speech in a lot of ways.
It's still nice. I really like it's
meant with good intentions.
Yeah,
you know, like her. I think that comes across. You know, that while she's saying some stuff that's going to be depressing and distressing to Hunter, it's stuff that he probably will be better off having heard.
Mm-hmm.
We do these moments every once in a while. You know, one of the big ones was Hunter himself back in issue 4 when he kind of talks about why he's not responding to the things around him and that idea of somebody who's sort of a spectator of genre fiction and consumer of genre fiction suddenly finding themselves in it. You know, you can find yourself in a place where, you know, every issue you have somebody doing a monologue and that can cause you problems. So I try to use them sparingly, but it's meant to be a sort of truce moment between the two of them. You know, that they'd been at each other's throats and had said some stuff to each other that, you know, they may not have entirely meant, and Zoe's obviously been barking orders an awful lot. So it's meant to be that sort of moment where they put the guns down and talk and be normal and be civil to one another, and they actually, you know, they kind of connect as a result of it, you know, that you could see that these two could be friends, you know, and then problems arise. But you can see how it very easily could have gone a different way.
I had in my notes here that this is Zoe's Fight Club speech, where it's the you know, you don't know who you are until you get hit in the mouth thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't really know until things go wrong,
yeah,
which is
exactly.
Actually, you know, you've been talking about that a lot, even without my prompt on it. So mm-hmm. I think that it was well placed in there. And I really love the line. He has a good line with her where he says it's like I'm on autopilot or something.
Sure.
And that's the nobody ever knows what they'll do one.
Yeah.
The other one I really like is you need to find some girl who's not doing you a favor every time she looks in your direction.
Yeah.
That's probably my favorite line out of her whole speech here.
Well, I think it sums up. There's a lot of guys who spend, you know, their teenage years doing this. You know, hunters, you know, one of the reasons why Hunter connects with the audience as much as he does is because, you know, this is something a lot of people do, you know, which is sort of fling themselves into hopeless crushes one after the other. And regardless of the validity of his feelings towards Casey, or regardless of you know, what their relationship is or isn't, it's probably fair to say Casey is not Hunter's first crush, you know, and Zoe's seen this kind of thing before. She's seen it plenty. She's probably been the subject of it more than a few times. So it's Zoe being smarter than Hunter to a large extent. As you know, as I don't look, I don't think that it's at all strange for a guy to have a conversation with a girl on a subject like this and come away feeling like he learned a great deal. So you know, it's a good moment for the two of them.
Well, I think in the last podcast that we did, we sort of talked about how we all kind of know, you know, we knew girls in high school like Casey and like Zoe, maybe not like Jade, but, you know, not in the terms of how far her mind goes. But, you know, mm-hmm. we knew girls like that. So there is definitely the certain sense of familiarity.
Sure.
Although personally, I never knew anybody who... I didn't know anybody like Zoe who was as blunt as Zoe gets. That's probably the only
disconnect. See, I did. Yeah. See, I feel like I've known a few Zoes in my life. Like I feel like I've you know, I think that there are, people like Zoe in situations where you can get away with saying what you think, you know, which is I think where Zoe's been. You know, Zoe's set up her life so that, you know, she's in charge a lot of the time, so that gives her the freedom to sort of speak her mind. But yeah, she's a very, very direct person.
So as we begin to close this issue out, we get the Zoe stalker sequence.
Yeah.
Now, I actually, before we talk about it, let's just point out that this is the issue that has Saul Goodman and Dina Pilgrim,
right,
from Powers and Breaking Bad, which are I love those little sneaks in there.
Right.
Yeah.
No, fantastic job there by Joe. He made some great choices. I had not seen past the first season of Breaking Bad when he did this.
Mm.
I'm a very late joiner. Now I'm all the way caught up, but so I didn't quite quite get it. But as I watched the show, boy, was I glad that he did this.
Right.
Somebody get Bob Odenkirk his Emmy.
So the stalker sequence of Zoe, we'll talk about the flashback sequence second, but the last time we saw something like this, I thought it was very noticeable that you never, ever see Zoe's face.
Mm-hmm.
And I took this to mean a very specific thing in what it meant about who was actually doing the murdering. And that I'm going to go so far as to say in the final issue of this arc, you actually sort of touch upon that idea.
Mm-hmm.
But is Zoe our predator of the arc?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, I think part of the fun of the way that Joe set up that last shot is even then, even still, you know, lots of people were saying that that can't be her. There's got to be something different. There's got to be something else here. And that's what you were supposed to be doing at that point. So
I was right among them. I think I've been spouting that since issue 7, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and again, you know, I mean, the whole idea is that the jury could not come in on her before we needed it to. So, not directly seeing her face like that and everything, you know, it can help in that regard because it just gives you one more possibility to cling on to other than the fact that she's doing this.
So Maggie, we meet her, and we have to say goodbye so quickly. But is it wrong to assume that this is probably not the last we've seen of her?
This is the last that you will see her.
You're gonna go on record for that one?
I'm gonna go on record there. And, I mean, you never say never. I shouldn't say it. You never say never. But there are no plans for you to see Maggie.
And see, I don't mean in like, you know, that she's not dead. I'm pretty aware that she's not surviving this one, but you know, there's always flashback sequences. She could make an appearance somewhere. What I want to ask is, do you think Maggie's a good gal?
I do. Of course I do. I really do. Yeah. Yeah.
You don't think she has any ulterior motives, perhaps?
No. Maggie's a sweetheart. She was created and lived her very short life on the pages to be a sweetheart. So if you're going towards maybe she had it coming,
not in that way. But you know, I've been watching. I always watch a lot of movies, but I remember I'd been watching a lot of like conspiracy based films and things like that. And like, you know, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy and all these movies where no one is exactly like they appear. And the idea kind of got in my head that, you know, maybe there's a reason why Maggie had to die. That is beyond just Zoe needed to go and kill somebody.
Oh, well, as far as if there's a reason why some people are being killed rather than others, you know, that's a different question. Mm-hmm. And one that I definitely won't answer. but good try. I mean, it was you went around the back on that one.
I've got to think of ways to trip you up.
You know, it was good.
So the other sequence here is, you know, Zoe going to a funeral, but this is another example where, you know, we have no idea who's taking her to the funeral.
Sure.
So I don't think it's too outside of the realm of possibility to assume that it's maybe somebody more important than just Zoe's foster mother or father.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Maybe so.